A warning before we start. This podcast does discuss the topic of child abuse and neglect. There will also be strong language.
It's the evening of June 27th, 2022. Teresa Fogel gets a text message from Jacelyn McGackie, the caseworker who took her kids from her.
I got a message from her saying, "This is Jacelyn with Children's Services. I am with Rylan and she wants to talk to you. Are you able to talk?"
Rylan is Teresa's 9-year-old daughter. Teresa hasn't seen her or her other children since Jacelyn put them in a car 2 days ago and drove off.
I got it immediately. We get on the phone. I'm on the phone with Rylan. She's like, "Hi, Mommy. I miss you. We just got to this foster home that they're leaving us at, and, you know, Jason's in the background explaining, like, we brought the boys with us so that they could see where the girls were going to see if they were okay with this place."
The boys are Teresa's teenage sons, Josiah and Azriel. After dropping the girls off, Jacelyn is taking them to Butler County to stay with their aunt, Jamie Boger. Now's their opportunity to see the foster home and say goodbye to their sisters. Almost immediately, there's a red flag.
First, I heard Rylan saying, "It smells really bad in here, like cat pee."
This is the first time Teresa has heard anything from her children in 2 days. That's a long time for a parent. And rather than reassuring her, this phone call is making her even more concerned.
And I'm like, "Azriel," I said, "are the conditions of this house a place that I would leave you or let any of you spend the night at?" He says, "No, but if it gets cleaned up, I guess." And I'm like, "Cleaned up? What's wrong with the conditions of this house?" He's like, "I don't know. There's spots all over the carpet." And then Rylan's like, "It smells so bad in here." In the background, they can all hear me. Mm-hmm. And then, as he said, there are papers and garbage and toys and junk laying everywhere. The only room that is clean in this house is the room the girls are going to be sleeping in. And I'm like, "Really?" He was like, "This is not up to your standards." Even Josiah in the background, who I wasn't even speaking to, was saying, "Absolutely not. Not anything my mother would allow us to ever spend the night at."
At this point, Josiah has allegedly played a significant role in getting himself and his siblings removed from Teresa. But even he apparently has reservations about the foster home where his sisters will be staying.
The last question I said is, "Did these people know that you guys were coming?" Josiah in the background says no. And then over top of him, she goes, "Well, they knew we were coming. They just didn't know what time."
She being Jacelyn.
I said, "Well, it's 7 o'clock at night. I'm pretty sure if they knew my kids were coming, they had all day to clean that house." She gets off the phone saying she's going to contact her supervisor. I said, "Please find another place for my children to go. This is not okay with me."
Shortly afterward, Jacelyn texts Teresa to say the mess was just a bunch of toys and papers. She says the foster parents will make sure it all gets cleaned up. Teresa isn't satisfied and replies to Jacelyn.
I said, "My children literally just told me otherwise. You need to find someplace safer for them to go. Obviously, my children don't live in a trashy environment or they wouldn't have mentioned it. This is not okay. I am not happy about this, and my kids are not okay either. None of them sound right. Rylan is devastated. Ev is upset, and the boys don't even know what to say. They're scared."
From WOUB News, this is episode 4 of 150 Days. I'm Teo Peck Suzuki.
And I'm David Forster.
If you haven't listened to the other episodes, we suggest you do so. It might be hard to follow what's going on otherwise. There's one other thing Teresa says to Jacelyn that we want to note here.
"I want my children in counseling by the end of the week. By the time I see them for my first visit, somebody better be getting something together for them. They have the right to have somebody to talk to, and they need a counselor immediately."
Remember that. And remember when it happens. The evening of June 27th, 2 days after the agency took her children.
A few days after the girls arrive at the foster home, Teresa's mother, Cheryl Boger, calls Children's Services to say she also has concerns. She's heard about the girls from Teresa, and she gets the impression that something isn't right. But Children's Services tell Cheryl not to worry. They say the girls are safe now that they're no longer with Teresa.
Teresa had wanted Rylan and Everly to stay with Cheryl, their grandmother, after the removal. That's actually pretty normal for child welfare. It's called a kinship placement. But for some reason, even though the boys go straight to their Aunt Jamie, the girls don't go to their grandmother Cheryl. Instead, they go to a foster home.
We should mention, by the way, Cheryl is not the only person who has offered to take the girls in. Sue McGee, the mother of Rylan's friend Xavier, has also put her name forward. But the agency apparently never calls her back.
Back at the foster home, the situation continues to deteriorate.
Xavier was able to talk to her a couple times while she was there. Okay. And she would fill us in on things that were going on there.
This is Sue McGee speaking.
And I was like, Rylan, you need to not say things like that out in the open. And she was like, I don't care. She said, I'm not happy here. I have to ask to eat. She said, I just wanted a banana, and she wouldn't even let me have it because it was interfering with her son's bedtime. She said, I'm hungry. So, I mean, I instantly felt horrible.
You might remember that Sue tried to reassure Rylan on the day of the removal. Rylan was scared, and Sue told her not to worry because Athens County had the nicest foster homes. But it turns out the foster home isn't even in Athens County. It's in Muskingum County, roughly an hour's drive north. And it's not quite as nice as Sue promised.
Of course, Sue couldn't possibly have known at the time what was going to happen, but she feels guilty nonetheless.
And it gets worse. The foster parents have a son, and Rylan says he's not happy about sharing his house.
She was telling me about the eating, and then the little boy picks on her a lot and threatens to shove her down the stairs, and that when he would hit her and things that the mom wouldn't say anything about it.
Rylan has no one she can go to for help. Her mom can't help. The foster parents are obviously not helping. Teresa says Jacelyn isn't answering Rylan's calls, though we can't confirm that. And there are other issues, too. The foster parents leave the girls outside unsupervised. At one point, Rylan has to grab Everly out of the road to keep her from getting hit by a car. Another time, the foster mom threatens to leave Everly alone at home because she can't find her shoes.
Of course, Sue isn't the only person who's hearing about all this. Rylan also tells Teresa what's happening over the phone. Or at least, she starts to.
I was on speakerphone. Like, she had me on speakerphone. So when she was telling me all this...
This being everything about the food and the problems with the foster parent's son.
I said, hang on a minute, Rylan. I said, you just said that they won't do anything about their son no matter what, and they keep telling you to play with him. She was like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, I'm writing all this down. That's what I said. I'm writing all this down. Everything you're telling me, I'm writing it down. And then, bam, I called back to talk to Rylan that night. Not allowed to talk to her anymore. It has to be supervised. Supervised by who? Well, then when I finally get supervised phone calls, it's the same person supervising them. So what difference does it make how many times she calls me?
This does not exactly put Teresa's mind at ease.
So all subsequent calls then are supervised by the foster mom.
Yes. And I was only getting... one phone call a week. I was only allowed to talk to my children from 1 to 1:30, and that didn't start right away.
This is through Children's Services? They're
yes.
telling you this?
Yes.
Okay, so Children's Services says you can talk to your children?
But they didn't inform me. No, they told Rylan. You can call your mom, but you can only talk to her from 1 to 1:30. I have nothing telling me how long I get in phone calls. I have nothing stating anything in emails that you get 30 minutes to talk to your daughter. This is what they have told my daughter to tell me. There is nothing in any kind of statement stating mom gets 30-minute phone calls with her daughter once a week.
Teresa wants to know everything that's happening with her girls in foster care. She's worried about them, as one imagines most parents would be.
And now, seemingly in response to her concerns, the agency is making it harder for her to talk to her daughter.
Teresa also gets supervised in-person visits with Rylan and Everly once a week at the Office of Athens County Children's Services. At the second of these visits, on July 8th, Teresa notices a bruise on Rylan's arm. Teresa asks her daughter how she got the bruise. Rylan tells her the foster parent's son hit her with his tablet. The Children's Services employee supervising the visit intervenes immediately.
You're saying the visit supervisor kept telling her to change the subject.
Rylan, we can't talk about that. You're going to have to change the subject.
Can't talk about being hit?
Yes. telling my daughter pretty much that we're not allowed to talk about what's going on in this foster home. And I'm like, how is my daughter supposed to tell me if she's okay or not, if she's not allowed to talk about it? I'm right there. They're just trying to cover this up.
It's not hard to see why Teresa might start to think she's caught in some big cover-up. First of all, from her perspective, everything that's happened, the whole removal, is already wrong. And now, whenever she tries to raise some concern, like why her daughter has a bruise on her arm, which is something many parents would want to ask about, she gets shut down. No explanation.
It's standard procedure that talking about the foster home is off-limits during supervised visits, even if things are going great. But it's easy to see why Teresa sees some kind of cover-up. She suspects things are not going well at this foster home. And no matter what she does, the agency seems to respond by shutting her out.
Meaning she just has to trust the agency to be monitoring this foster home effectively. And Teresa's trust in the agency is already very low.
Things finally come to a head the following week. Teresa brings food to have a picnic with Rylan and Everly.
We were sitting on the floor before we had even started eating. And I'm like, Everly, what happened to your legs? I mean, I'm talking bruises this big around on my four-year-old's legs, yellow and black. And then I look at her and there's another big one right here, same spot on the other leg. And I'm like, Rylan, what happened to your sister's legs? And when Rylan turns her head, she's got a big old mark by her ear right here. And I'm like, what happened to Sissy's legs? And she keeps going. Now, you're the visit supervisor, right? Me and my kids are sitting on the floor. She's looking up, looking at me, looking at Everly, looking over. Everly got thrown off the top of a slide by Nolan. And then looks over at that lady. And I'm like, what?
Teresa wants to know what's going on, but she can see that Rylan is worried the visit supervisor will intervene again.
I'm like, what about the other bruise on her leg? And she's like, I don't know. And I'm like, what happened to your face? What is this red mark from? Now, Jacelyn did tell me that Rylan had fallen outside and hit her head and didn't tell anybody, but there was a scab there. Like, that had already done, almost healed. This is a completely fresh red mark on my child's face. And I'm like, she keeps looking at this. I don't know. I'm like, you don't know what happened to your face. And at that point, I am very concerned.
Teresa realizes she isn't going to get anything out of Rylan with the visit supervisor watching. So she comes up with a plan.
When we went into the bathroom, I had like 3 minutes left before the visit was over. And I did it on purpose. Like, obviously, I asked my daughter if you need to go to the bathroom the whole visit. She's 4 years old. But I'm like, you know, go to the bathroom. Me and the girls both go in there, whatever. And I'm looking at my kids. You know, I'm looking at the bruises on her legs. And I'm looking at Rylan's face. And Rylan then whispers in my ear and says, Mommy, I'm scared. Please, please don't make us go back to this. Please. Don't make us go back to this foster home. Please, Mommy, don't make us go back there. They're so mean to me. They're so mean to me and Everly. We don't feel comfortable there. Please, Mommy, please. I mean, whispering this in my ear. And I'm not allowed to even react because I can't walk out of the bathroom like that, you know? Then they're going to not let me take my kids to the bathroom.
Just like that, all of Teresa's fears as a mother who's been separated from her children, seem to come true. And there's nothing she can do about it. She can't take her girls home with her. She has to let them go back to the foster home.
The only thing Teresa really can do is complain. So she writes an angry email, tells the agency that she's, quote, appalled and devastated, unquote, asks them again to arrange counseling for her children.
Really lays into them, tells them this boy is pushing her girls off playground equipment and no one is doing anything about it.
Of course, Teresa doesn't expect her email to change much. So she decides that if they're not going to listen to her, she's going to file a grievance. The problem is, she can't file a grievance until she meets with Jacelyn's supervisor, Stephanie McDaniel.
Almost every time I've left the agency, I said, I want to speak with the... I need to set up a meeting with Jacelyn's supervisor. And they just look around at each other like, nobody will schedule anything for me.
There's a word for this kind of feeling. Kafkaesque. From the author Franz Kafka, who wrote novels about people caught in bureaucratic machinery they can't escape.
I asked for a grievance form, and Jaclyn, in one of the emails, sends me the list of things I have to do in order to file a grievance on them. The first is meet with the caseworker. The second is meet in your home with the caseworker. The third is meet with the supervisor and the caseworker. They won't let me get to step three. They won't let me meet with the supervisor.
Everyone who works in and around the system acknowledges that removing children is traumatic. Kids are bonded with their parents in a way that has huge psychological importance. Rupture that bond, and the consequences for children can be devastating.
In 2019, the American Bar Association published a guidebook for lawyers to help them understand these impacts and use them at trial. Some of the studies they cite show that children, quote, generally suffer worse outcomes when removed than if they had been allowed to remain in marginal homes, end quote.
That is the big lie of American child welfare. It equates child removal with child safety.
That's Richard Wexler, executive director of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform and a vocal critic of the American child welfare system.
The problem with this system is not that it hurts parents, though of course it does. The problem is that it hurts children. It hurts children by inflicting the enormous inherent emotional trauma of being torn from everyone they know and love. That trauma, the motivation may be different, but that trauma is the same in Athens, Ohio, as it is on the Mexican border. So if you remember the cries of the children taken there, it's the same.
Wexler is not the only person warning that the act of removal itself, never mind what happens in foster care, is extremely damaging. Vivek Sankaran is a professor of law at the University of Michigan who has written extensively on the juvenile court system.
This process of removal immediately needs to be reformed. You have to have a system where parents with their lawyers, soon after this removal happens or before it happens, should have a chance quickly to challenge the removal in a full, robust hearing.
You may recall from the last episode how Teresa's first hearing went. It was anything but full and robust. She didn't even have a lawyer. And that's typical. Sankaran believes that needs to change.
If you wait for the adjudication hearing, it's just too late.
The hearing Sankaran is referring to, the adjudication, is the first time most parents can realistically challenge the agency in court. In most states, including Ohio, the adjudication doesn't happen until several weeks after the removal. So to put this in context, Teresa is still waiting for her adjudication while all of this is happening with the foster home. It's scheduled for August 8th, and we're still only in mid-July.
Now, none of this means removal is never necessary. The point that people like Wexler and Sankaran are trying to make is removal is a drastic and extremely damaging step, one that should be used only in the most extreme cases.
And on paper, that's something agencies don't entirely disagree with. They know removals are problematic and are trying to do something about it. In fact, Athens County Children's Services, the very agency that took Teresa's kids, has a school outreach program designed specifically to connect children and parents with resources and prevent things from ever reaching the point where removal is on the table. These outreach caseworkers have offices in local schools filled with extra clothes, snacks, hygiene products. They also help with kids who have behavioral issues and give advice to parents.
The state of Ohio has also taken measures to give caseworkers alternatives to removal.
About 15 years ago, Ohio introduced a different response, an alternative response, that is a little closer to the social work that we really want to do with families.
That's Scott Britton, Assistant Director of the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio.
The timelines are a little bit different. We don't go in and identify a perpetrator or a victim. We identify what services might be needed in the home to stabilize that family, because we recognize early on that removal into foster care is not going to solve this problem. There was not enough abuse or neglect to justify the trauma that that would introduce into the family. And so alternative response is almost half of our caseload right now.
So that sounds great. But if you look at the numbers, caseworkers still use traditional response slightly more than alternative response. Traditional response being safety plan, removal, and a lengthy court process. That's still a lot of removals producing a lot of traumatized kids, more than what critics think is appropriate. And that's not even taking into account the problems with foster care.
I'm not saying it's a fair presumption, but they say, well, the foster family has had to go through training and such.
This is Denise Ferguson, a public defender in Cuyahoga County who specializes in juvenile court. She says agencies trust foster parents more than actual parents because of the vetting potential foster families go through.
Ferguson thinks this idea that foster parents are especially trustworthy is just incorrect.
I handled a case in Summit County where a foster father of the year, okay, he was considered the best of all foster fathers. Won award, yada, yada, yada. Agency loved him. He raped the boys that were put into his care. I represented a mother on one of those cases, and they removed from her because when the boy came out of foster care that was raped, he had been taught, this is how you show you care. So he was showing his siblings how he cared for them. He perped on them. They removed from mother because mother couldn't protect, okay? And the only reason this child was doing that is because that happened to him when he was removed. And people will say, well, you know, if mom hadn't done anything wrong, then that wouldn't have happened to her kid, so we're still going to blame the parent.
Now, not all foster homes are like this, obviously, but Fergus's point is that some of them, too many of them, are abusive or neglectful.
Well, and I think she's asking, given that, why is the system offering foster parents the benefit of the doubt more than actual parents?
Yeah, that too. It's like removing kids is traumatic enough, but then if you put them in a foster home where they get abused, maybe even worse than when they were with their parents, there's something really disturbing about that. At least that's how reform advocates like Richard Wexler see it.
One of the data points they can give you, but which is such nonsense it doesn't matter anyway, is percentage of rate of abuse in foster care. They'll give you a figure because it's in some data they have to report to the federal government. And the figure will say, in any given year, we find abuse or neglect in only 1% of foster homes. Or it may be even lower than that, but that's typical. 1% is actually high end on official figures. And yet, one independent study after another finds abuse in 25% to 33% of family foster homes and an even worse rate in group homes and institutions. Why such a vast difference? Because the official figures are the agencies investigating themselves. They have a huge incentive to see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, and write no evil in the case file.
We asked Matt Starkey, the public information officer for Athens County Children's Services, how his agency vets foster parents. Here's what he had to say.
There's a process directed by the code on what you need to do to vet foster parents and then certify them to be foster parents. And for us, we do home studies, and those are very extensive, where our foster parent recruiter will go into the home, will interview parents, will interview other children in the home if there are other children, will do a background check on the parents. There's different components that we do to vet the parents, and it's like a year-long process too, so it's not like someone just becomes a foster parent overnight.
Now, all that sounds fine, but Starkey did acknowledge that there aren't enough foster homes in Athens County to place all the children the agency removes. So they have to go to other counties. That's how Rylan and Everly wound up in Muskingum. And it's not just Athens having that problem.
I would be remiss if I did not say that we also have a workforce shortage in foster caregivers.
Here's Scott Britton again.
We need more foster parents. We have a lot of foster parents now who are willing to take younger children, particularly infants that they hope to adopt down the road. We need foster parents who are willing to work with older children with behavioral health challenges so that we don't have to place those children in congregate care or residential facilities, which we know they don't get good outcomes from.
So all of Ohio has a foster care shortage. Maybe that helps explain why some problematic foster homes slip through the cracks, or why smaller issues go unaddressed.
So what I'm wondering, I guess, is, you know, following the vetting process, if there are issues that emerge, I mean, are we just kind of hoping that the vetting process gets it right, there's not going to be any issues? Or, like, is there a way to kind of catch issues after that process and respond to them?
Well, so, yeah, we work with our foster parents along the way. We provide assistance to them, and we have different events where we bring foster families in. And you know, when it comes to visitation, like if there's supervised visitation, we have that on our campus, so the foster parents will bring kids in. And, you know, in the end, foster parents are, they can be the subject of a referral to us. You know, if a child in foster care goes to school and says, I don't feel safe, to one of their teachers, I don't feel safe in my foster home right now, the teacher reports that, and that can be screened in or screened out. You know, it starts the process.
What Starkey says sounds reasonable, but then you have critics saying there's a big difference between what's supposed to happen and what does happen. Wexler says that's because the only people holding agencies accountable when it comes to foster care are the agencies themselves. So if the agencies are screwing up or are overwhelmed, which is something we talked about a couple episodes ago, well, who's going to catch that? And who's going to do something about it?
One thing we do know is the public really can't hold agencies accountable. And that's because almost everything about child welfare is confidential.
We as journalists don't get special access. What we can see is what you, the listener, can see. And we really can't see anything about what the agency does or how it addresses issues with foster homes. So, like Teresa, we just kind of have to take it on faith that they're doing what they're supposed to.
Which is another reason Wexler thinks the only solution to foster care is to have less of it, by giving parents better representation and conducting fewer removals. But better representation means attorneys who will be more likely to challenge children's services agencies and hold them to account.
But it's a political problem. Agencies don't want to fund somebody who will push back against them. A few agencies have been willing to do it for various reasons, but most of the time, they don't want that kind of pushback. And politically, it's portrayed as, oh, you're going to provide great defense for child abusers. No, you're going to actually be providing help for their children so they don't endure the misery of foster care or the risk of abuse in foster care.
Let's get back to Teresa now. At this point, the girl's father, Justin Johns, has also had visits with them. He's also pretty upset.
Every time I went to the visits, my girls seemed really scared and really, like, uneasy and, like, really, like, they would whisper to me, like, I'm not allowed to talk about things. I'm not allowed to do this. I'm not allowed to do that. And you know, the only time I really got information was when I went outside with them, because they didn't supervise any of my outside time. Rylan would tell me things there that, you know, things aren't okay and this and that. I brought that attention to them at the, you know, the center, you know, like, hey, you know, things aren't okay here. That the little boy was, you know, he'd make comments to them like, you're not even supposed to be here, and I don't know why you're here in my house. You're supposed to be at your house, and just being bullied, you know what I mean?
Teresa and Justin have both tried to get the agency to do something. Teresa's also tried, unsuccessfully thus far, to file a grievance. So now she's going to the Athens County Sheriff's Department. She thinks, I'm going to file a police report on this foster home.
It doesn't go well. The deputy tells her that the foster home is in Muskingum County and therefore out of their jurisdiction. More or less brushes her off. But Teresa being Teresa, she is undeterred. She submits an online complaint to the Muskingum County Sheriff's Department and the department sends a deputy out to investigate.
The date is July 19th. Muskingum County Sheriff's Deputy Adam McGee attempts to contact Teresa's caseworker, Jaslyn, but gets no response. He arrives at the foster home at 9:31. There, he speaks with a foster mother, who tells him everything is fine and the girls are well fed. She does acknowledge that her son has hit the girls, but says they all hit one another and insists it's never left a mark. She also says Rylan is upset about being in foster care and gets mad about having to ask for snacks. During the conversation, which is happening on the porch, McGee is able to see into the residence. He writes, quote, "I was able to see into the residence, which appeared to be maintained and not of poor living conditions."
Then McGee asks if he can talk to the girls alone. The foster mom agrees and leaves the three of them, McGee, Rylan, and Everly, to speak. McGee writes that Rylan initially says everything is fine, but he does notice that Everly has bruises on her legs. Everly isn't talking, so he asks Rylan what happened. Rylan admits to the deputy that the foster parent's son pushed Everly off a slide.
Having confirmed that aspect of Teresa's story, McGee calls Athens County Children's Services. He reaches out to one of the supervisors, Travis Boggs, who tells McGee the agency is aware of the issues at this foster home and is looking into them. We never get any clarification as to what that means, but we do know that the next day, Rylan and Everly are in a new foster home in a small town about 30 miles away.
Jaslyn called at 7:30 p.m. The girls are with a woman in Heath, Ohio. That's a much better place, and that the girls seem to be adjusting okay. There was a playground and a pool at the apartment. Rylan asked her, speaking of Jaslyn, to tell me that they are getting snacks. So she said that this woman was waiting on them to get there. She was going to take them to go get snacks. And that they were planning on painting each other's nails and having a movie night. And I'm like, oh, God, thank God. Rylan was excited. She was okay at this point. Rylan called me on the 20th. And the first thing she says to me is, "Mom, what did you report?" And I'm like, "I told you, Mommy's doing everything that she can, Rylan. It's not that I wasn't doing anything. It's that nobody was listening to me. And I had to do this myself." So I got my kids out of there, and they are much better now.
Before we wrap this episode up, we need to go back to Teresa's mom, Cheryl Boger. Remember, she wanted to take the girls from the beginning, but for reasons that were never totally clear, this didn't happen.
I asked her why they were in foster care and if we could have them. And of course, it started then, but it was a little slow because the caseworker didn't seem to respond like I feel she should have. And my granddaughter, even Rylan, tried to talk to her several times or get her to call her on the phone, and she never returned her phone calls.
So Cheryl spends much of July badgering the agency, saying, "Hey, can I take these girls? I'm worried about them," and so forth.
We've gone through the activity log Children's Services kept for this case, and it seems like Children's Services starts the process for doing a home study for Cheryl fairly early. Unfortunately, the person who does home studies in Butler County, where Cheryl lives, was on vacation for much of July, which slowed things down considerably. But this doesn't explain why the girls couldn't go to Cheryl on an emergency basis.
Remember, the boys, Josiah and Azriel, go straight to their Aunt Jamie's house, which is just a few blocks from Cheryl's. This was an emergency placement, meaning it was done before the agency had time to do a full home study. In fact, we even have the preliminary home study the agency did for Jamie, in which someone has written that they will do a full study later when they have time. We still don't know why that didn't happen with Cheryl.
Teresa thinks it's deliberate. We obviously can't verify that because we can't see the reasoning behind most of Children's Services' decisions. But we do know, because it's written in the activity log, that the agency had some reservations about Cheryl. She has a leg wound that impedes her mobility, and there was some strange uncertainty about her living situation.
Cheryl apparently told Children's Services she lives with her daughter, Jamie, which is not true. She actually lives with another of her daughters named Christina. In other words, she misidentifies which daughter she lives with.
Which I suspect is something many parents with multiple children can sympathize with.
And for whatever reason, the caseworker decides this means Cheryl is untrustworthy.
That's what the activity log seems to suggest, anyway.
So Cheryl has to wait. Quite a long time, as it turns out. She doesn't get approved to take the girls until July 26th, 1 month after the removal and after everything that's happened with the foster home in Muskingum. And she says the girls don't actually come to her until August.
In total, Rylan and Everly have spent 6 weeks in foster care. Half of that at a foster home where they were physically abused.
Teresa is relieved when the girls finally go to their grandmothers.
I'm allowed to speak to my children every day, 100 times a day if I want to. And I do. I talk to them about 4 or 5 times a day, which is nice because it's all on video and I get to see my kids all the time, you know?
But that relief is tempered by her fury at what her daughters went through.
Rylan, like her and I, have talked about that place. And I mean, my daughter's traumatized from being in that house. That foster home, she is traumatized. She said that mom and dad fought all the time. That she got blamed for a tablet that came up missing, that little boy kept hitting them with, and how, like, you know, Everly didn't just have one nosebleed, she had multiple, it was never reported. That little boy would just constantly hit them, he threw Rylan down the stairs. I mean, Everly was in the middle of the street, she almost got hit by a car. Rylan had to get her out of the middle of the street, they weren't supervised ever.
Teresa isn't the only one who feels that way. Here's Cheryl.
Rylan is just, she's never going to forget. Never. She can tell you every day she was in each one and what they did and what they couldn't do. And she don't sleep. She's in school here. And she don't have to be up until 7. But she was up at 5 o'clock yesterday. I thought, oh, Lord. But she can't sleep. She just, and she has some pretty rough dreams. And she's just dying in that way.
There's one more thing that happens in July that has nothing to do with foster homes, but that is still really important. Or rather, it's what doesn't happen that matters. Children's Services does not file a case plan for Teresa's case.
A case plan is the document that outlines what parents are supposed to do to get their kids back. So whatever problems are in the home, the case plan is the way they're going to address them. And by law, the agency has to file it within 30 days of the removal.
So removal is on June 25th. July 25th comes and goes, August rolls around, and there's still no case plan. Teresa literally has no idea what she's even supposed to do to get her kids back.
Meanwhile, the adjudication, Teresa's one real chance to challenge the agency in court, is fast approaching. Teresa has kept extensive records on the agency's mistakes up to this point. She believes they have no evidence for any of the allegations against her. And now, with the missing case plan, they've also broken the law. So she's ready to fight.
If Teresa wins at the adjudication, her case is closed. Her children come home, that's it. Story over. But if she doesn't, the agency is basically in control of her family's future. She will have to do whatever they say and hope it's enough to get her kids back. We'll find out what happens in the next episode of 150 Days. Days is a production of WOUB Public Media. The podcast was written and produced by Teo Peck Suzuki and David Forster. Adam Rich is the audio engineer. Music by Caitlin Krause and Brad Swinarski. To read the digital version of this story, go to woub.org/150-days.